From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Local journalism is widely in tough shape these days. Cutbacks all over, newsrooms trimmed, and more news deserts, areas that aren't covered by the local news organization. There are high costs of losing local news, implications for awareness, community, accountability, and democracy. Can local journalism be saved? This hour on Point, local news in trouble. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the local news coverage thin out where you are? Have you seen it go away? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, Bob Schieffer of CBS News looks at the deluge of news at some levels, both real and fake. But first, the local news problem. We had a federal report out a few years ago. It's concluded a shortage of reporting at the local level manifests itself in invisible ways. Stories not written, scandals not exposed, government waste not discovered, health dangers not identified in time, local elections involving candidates about whom we know little. Let's look at it. Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Sullivan. She's media columnist at The Washington Post, spent over 30 years at the Buffalo News, 13 of those years as its editor. Former New York Times public editor, her latest piece in the Post is Tension Between Trump and the Media. That's nothing compared to journalism's worst crisis. And she's talking about local news. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Margaret Sullivan, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Can you paint a picture of what is happening across the country when it comes to local news organizations?
Well, specifically with newspapers, which tend to be the largest and, you know, most dominant news organizations in their communities, they are shrinking. They, you know, I'll give you the example of my old newsroom in Buffalo, mm-hmm. where I inherited 200 people from the last editor. And by the time I left, some dozen years later, we were down to something like 140 people. Mm-hmm. And that was done through round after round of buyout and attrition, not layoffs, happily. But this has happened all over the country. Newsrooms are typically something like half what they were.
You have firsthand experience with this. What happens when a newspaper goes through that kind of consolidation or cutbacks, shrinkage?
Well, what happens is that you lose reporting power. So you might have had, for example, a reporter covering higher education and a reporter covering, you know, other forms of education. Now you might have one reporter who, yes, still covers education, but that reporter also is covering county hall. So, you know, you no longer have the depth, the expertise, and, you know, the sort of the spread of the depth and breadth of news. And that really hurts. To some extent, we don't know what we don't know. What are the stories that we're not seeing? What's the corruption that may be taking place that we'll never know about because we don't have a reporter covering an area which could be a coverage area, but it also could be a geographical area?
This may be in rural areas which are no longer covered, but it doesn't have to be. I'm reading here a story from not long ago by one of your colleagues here at the Post, Paul Fari, about East Palo Alto, California. I mean, this is right in the heart of Silicon Valley. And they had elections going on and really a news desert and just nowhere to read about, nowhere to become aware in any kind of meaningful way of what was going on in their own community.
That's right. And these news deserts, as they're called, are happening all over the country, certainly in rural areas and sort of ex-urban areas. But as you say, can be happening in a suburb or even a city. So it's really a problem. You know, we need local journalists who know their communities, who are good reporters, who can bring the news to us. But what's happened here is that the business model has really disintegrated before our eyes just in the past, you know, particularly in the past decade, but it started happening before that too. Mm-hmm. And with the business model falling apart, you know, news organizations, they're not doing this to punish anyone. They're doing it to try to stay vital and stay alive. And it's become a tremendous challenge because print advertising has gone away. The internet came along and really destroyed that. And so now we're kind of groping for other solutions.
Classified ads went online very quickly back in the day. And then print advertising more broadly than that. I mean, you're saying advertisers just don't they still need to get local patrons into their businesses, or that's just not the way it works anymore?
It's a vicious cycle. You know, as circulation of newspapers has fallen, it's no longer absolutely the best way to get your message out, or it may not be. Big department stores don't really even exist anymore. The whole retail model has changed. People are shopping online. And, you know, the whole economics that supported newspapers has just changed so drastically. As you say, the demise of classified advertising, which was a huge boon to newspapers, is really mostly gone now. And when that went away, and it went fast, we started to have real problems.
We've got listeners writing in from around the country. Greg writes to us, says, local newspapers in Southwest Indiana are fewer than 25 pages in the daily editions now. The paper's printed 100 miles away, so Friday night local high school sporting events don't make the Saturday paper, and on it goes. What's happening? Are chains jettisoning local papers? Are they centralizing news coverage? I mean, how are owners dealing with this, Margaret?
Well, this is another big trend that's happened, is that many local newspapers now are owned by chains. And some of the chains are better than others about the journalism. But the truth of all of them is that they're not local. So when you might have had a family ownership, and, you know, in some places you still do. But for the most part, we're talking about out-of-town owners who are focused on the bottom line and focused on their shareholders rather than being focused on the local citizens and what's best for them. So in many ways, they're squeezing these local papers for profits, for the remaining profits that they can get out of them. And that's become a big problem.
How do some papers pull this off? We had an amazing conversation just a couple of weeks ago with reporters from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and they had done an astounding big project on opioid use and the kind of debasement and problems that had raised in their readership area. There's a local paper doing amazing work. I've got Garrett is writing to us online here saying, I'm features editor for a weekly news magazine in Western North Carolina. We cover six counties in the Great Smoky Mountains. We're increasing readership and subscriptions every year. He says, I believe people aren't sick of reading. They're sick of what they're reading. Hone in on real investigative reporting and important community features. I mean, you have organizations out there that are doing it, that are doing remarkable work somehow, Margaret.
That's right. And you know what newspapers have had to do is decide what they're going to focus on. So many of them smartly have decided we're going to really dig in to a few areas. But when you do that with a limited staff, a more limited staff than you used to have, you know, you can't, it's impossible to do more with less, which was the great urging as all these cuts were being made. We'll do more with less. You mm-hmm. cannot do more with less. You can pick your spots. And I think the smart leaders in newspapers and other news organizations are picking their spots and saying, yes, we're going to do this big investigative project, but that probably means that they're not going to cover every town council meeting in the area, and something has to give.
What's your fear about what's going on that we don't know about at the local level now? I mean, you had this federal report talking about scandals not exposed and waste not discovered in the government, health dangers not identified. Be granular with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just to be non-granular for a second, we know that trust in the news media is way down. But where it's not way down is with local people do tend to trust their local newspaper, their local radio station, their local TV station more than they trust the national media. So that's great. The bad part is that we're no longer at that level able to cover what we were able to cover before. And so, you know, maybe you're putting a lot of resources into sports because that's what people care about. And then you have to choose, well, we're not going to cover County Hall. Or not every meeting, whatever it is. And so the other thing we've learned from these public opinion polls is that people do value the watchdog function of the news media, and that's on the national and local level. So that's great, and we're good at that. But we We need people. It doesn't happen by magic. You know, the watchdog function, which means investigative reporting, is painstaking. It's time-consuming. It's expensive, and it doesn't happen by magic, and it doesn't happen without resources. So that's my worry.
We're talking with Bob Schieffer later in this hour of CBS on his podcast about the news. He talked with the Orlando Sentinel's managing editor, John Cutter, and they were talking about how cutbacks have hurt that paper's ability to keep an eye on local government and many papers.
Local corruption, I think that's already started. We used to be at every council and commission meeting, you know, across the four or five counties that make up Orlando. That's not true anymore. I know there are things that are happening that we're just missing because nobody's there. I hope the truth ultimately always comes out, and sometimes it does, but I think it's different when you don't see a reporter sitting in the front row at your council meeting every week.
Yeah, it's different. Margaret Sullivan is media columnist for The Washington Post. She was editor at the Buffalo News, was at the Buffalo News for a long time. Is there help on the horizon, Margaret, or are we just going to fly blind at the local level?
There is some help that's starting to crop up. You know, I'm not sure that it's going to solve the problem, but it's encouraging to see foundations like the Ford Foundation, the Knight Foundation, and others start to take – I mean, they have actually been taking this problem seriously, but now taking it more seriously. We're seeing nonprofits, foundations. There's a new sort of membership model in which you try to get – community citizens to support the paper, not just with a subscription, but by contributing and becoming more involved, which is something that we've, you know, seen in public media for a long time.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about local news gathering and how and why we're just getting less of it these days, what that costs us in terms of understanding our own communities, keeping local powers accountable. And you can join us this hour. Do you feel blind sometimes in your own community as to what's going on? Do you remember when the paper was on every doorstep, every morning, more or less? Are we still plugged in, aware, informed about what's going on in our own towns? And if your local news outlet stopped giving you what you need, how do we get that back? Margaret Sullivan's been thinking and writing about this for The Washington Post. She's media columnist there. She was editor of the Buffalo News for a long time. And she's with us today from Washington. I mean, local news organizations make a difference long before national news organizations had focused on Flint, Michigan, and its water problems. Local institutions, the Flint Journal, Michigan Radio, were diving into that story. Here's Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, produced a documentary called Not Safe to Drink, well before you heard about it, about what was happening in Flint.
Families in Flint have been taking extreme measures to avoid drinking their tap water. They worry. It's just not safe.
Hey, Gavin, what do we say about the water?
Don't drink the water is bad. We want kids water now.
Okay, there's a way to get your attention, but it took local reporting, shoe leather, to get that done. Here's part of an ad for the Reading Eagle, a newspaper in Reading, Pennsylvania. Staff photographer Susan Angstock explains why local journalism matters.
Local journalism is important because that's the only way you're going to get to know the people that live in your neighborhood, the people that live in your surrounding neighborhoods. Without it, government, local government will go unchecked.
And does it matter? Sure. I mean, here's MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. This is back in 2014, talking about how a local reporter, local newspaper reporter, broke the Chris Christie Bridgegate story with ultimately all of its ramifications.
Today's bombshell news about the administration of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and the world's busiest bridge and the manufactured traffic jam that choked the little town of Fort Lee. That story started with the local newspaper, The Record of Bergen County, where they had a few questions that needed answering, even when powerful people mocked them for asking.
The Bergen newspaper got on it, and we all saw what came after. Margaret Sullivan is with us from Washington. Margaret, how is this
paucity of news reporting spread around the country, around states? Is it rural? Is it big metro? Even there, when you get down to the gritty level where things matter, where's the shortage worst?
Well, it is all over. One of the worst areas has been at the state government level. The staffing of state bureaus, you know, news bureaus that cover state legislatures, is down very, very seriously, something like 40% over a 10-year period, according to one study. And that's, you know, that's where a lot of important stuff takes place. And so if no one's watching the store, some things, you know, you may just not know about state legislation that could very well affect your life. And that, you know, so that's happening. But I would say also certainly in rural areas and even within metro areas, it's just thinner than it used to be. So you don't have a beat reporter on every important beat. You have people sharing beats, or maybe you've decided, well, we really can't do that one because we want to do an investigative project. So I think that the efforts that are being made by newsrooms are heroic, and that there are a lot of talented people at the local who are local journalists, but they're really up against it. It's very tough to do this in a shrinking, constantly shrinking environment. And you don't know what the future is going to bring. I mean, this is only going in one direction in terms of the commercial business model. It is really not coming back.
What about, I mean, at the Post and Times, we've heard that the bigger papers, that their subscriptions have been up as people try and keep track of all this crazy flow of news lately. Are they suffering the same kind of cutbacks?
No, actually, some of the national newspapers have managed to right themselves, and it's really heartening to see. So the Post and the Times have had huge spikes in their subscriptions and in the support from people because they realize that this is an extremely important time to support what I like to call the reality-based press. But this is impossible at the local level. You know, you don't have the base, the entire country to draw from for subscriptions, or in some cases, the, you know, beyond our country's borders. You're limited to a community and the advertising of that community can generate. And it, in many cases, it's just not enough. So they're very, very different. And while it's fantastic to see the Post and the Times doing well and finding this new support, this isn't really true at the local level in many places.
Let's hear our listeners' experience. Kevin in Detroit, you're on the air with Margaret Sullivan. Thanks for calling, Kevin.
Hey. Hi. Hi, folks. So I got so much to say about this. I know I got a lot of time, but, you know, I there's a couple angles to this. I think that's hurting local journalism. One, with folks and the fake news campaign. But, you know, local television news, which I hate, I don't watch, I support my local papers. But, you know, local people are just so, you know, dumbed down to, you know, local TV news, which I call infotainment. They don't go in depth, and, you know, but, you know, there's a lot, you know, I think a lot of people still look to that, and, you know, but I think it's hurt print journalism. I think people don't want to get that deep into news anymore, and I think that TV news, TV local news in particular, has had a lot to do with that.
Kevin, let us pick it up. Margaret Sullivan, what about it? Kevin, first of all, sees infotainment emerging on local TV news. I wonder if that's under economic pressure as well. And he even raises this interesting point that readers or viewers, news consumers, if you will, their standards have dropped. Even their tastes have changed in a way that may make them less engaged citizens.
I've seen a lot of good work on local television, actually, and I think some of the local TV stations have made it their business to pick up the investigative work that is out there and have done very well with it. It's a way of distinguishing themselves from their competition. I mean, I get what he's saying. In general, it can be, you know, the cliche is if it bleeds, it leads, and, you know, it can be superficial, but not always. And I guess I disagree with Kevin, though I understand what he's saying about the hunger for important information. I feel like people really do feel a need and a hunger for in-depth and searching and, you know, valid news reporting. And I hope that they'll support it when they see it. It's extremely important for people to, you know, put their money where their desire for news is.
But there certainly are many, many ways you can turn your attention these days that have nothing to do with local news. Kathleen in Hartford, Connecticut. Kathleen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. I am, as I explained to your the person, I'm a former local print news reporter. And my difficulty with having a lack of good local news is not so much what the local people can get away with, but so more so the lethargy and ignorance on the part of the citizenship so that they can do the right thing in selecting the proper politicians and staying on top of what's really critical for their area. Now, of course, in Hartford, we have a big problem with our finances. Hartford, Connecticut is on the brink of bankruptcy. And I'd like to see a little bit more of an outcry among my peer group about what's going on, and I don't really see it.
Do you think it's not there because they're not getting the news, Kathleen, in these cutback days or something else? You're talking about lazy citizens?
You know what? I don't want to say people are lazy. I think it's more lethargy. It's a function of what pops up on the screen that proclaims what's important to you. We have the Hartford Current. The Hartford Current does a pretty good job of covering the local news. But again, it, like other daily newspapers, has been stripped of its reporters. It really has a difficult time. The news hole has shrunk enormously. So it's a problem. When you have to pick and choose the news to fill the hole, it's very difficult.
Yeah. And maybe not much there. Kathleen, I appreciate your call. Margaret, I mean, do you see the effects of this on communities, community cohesion or engagement diminishing? Or the other side of that coin, a culture of impunity that grows up in local governments if they know they're just not going to be kept track of?
I do, Tom. I think that one of the things that happens is that we lose this kind of village square that we once had with, you know, for example, two strong newspapers who were taking on different issues and, you know, people would buy both of them and there'd be competition. And it was the sort of strong, vibrant, robust news environment. We don't have that anymore. And I do think that, you know, there is the word you used of cohesion. I think we are pulled apart as communities because we don't have that sort of news source to pull us together and to give us something in common to speak about. So, you know, as far as, you know, what's going on that should be reported on that's going by the wayside, we don't know what we don't know. There could be corruption, and there could be corruption or lesser forms of that that we really should be keeping track of. And, you know, will it come to light eventually? I hope so, but not always. And so that's really a worry, too.
Gina in Charlotte, North Carolina. Gina, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. My comment was I used to work in a local TV newsroom. And at the time, you know, you had a reporter, you had a photographer, you had an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the cutbacks, you've got people having the one-man band. You know, you've got the reporter having to run the camera and go back and edit the piece, which I think gets people exhausted. And you've got, you know, one person doing everything. And it just really stretches that person thin.
Does it hit the quality of the news reporting, Gina?
I think so. I think, you know, if you've got somebody out there day after day doing, you know, everything, that person gets tired.
Yeah. Many hats being worn here as people try to deal with those cutbacks. And sounds like you've been on the front line of that. One more right here, Atlanta, Georgia. Roberta, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. It's an honor to speak with you.
You too.
I live in a small neighborhood in Atlanta called East Lake. And East Lake and Oakhurst, Kirkwood, these little neighborhoods have their own Facebook neighbor groups. And I would say that we get a lot of our news, local news, from sort of like the grapevine, you know, like neighbors telling neighbors
mm-hmm.
stuff that's going on. And a lot of our city council people are members of these groups, and they hear us directly via the social media posts in the neighborhood group. So certainly that doesn't take the place of investigative journalism, but I would say that a lot of that role has been sort of taken over by these social media groups now.
That is really interesting, and I want to look at that with Margaret Sullivan, just see how far that can go, how much of the slack that can pick up. Roberta, I appreciate your call there from Atlanta. Margaret, what about social media, Facebook groups, and all the rest? When city council members themselves may get involved directly in them, is that a substitute or a supplement to the local news that you see shrinking, falling by the wayside?
Well, I think it can definitely have value, and it certainly is very compelling to people to be talking to their neighbors about what's happening in their communities, particularly on questions about crime or, things that like that. So I think that's great. And, you know, there's a name for this, user-generated content and citizen journalism. These are real things that have cropped up. I think what they don't do and can't do is get deeper to look at, you know, to be able to get at documentation, to be able to look at things in a pattern. They tend to be, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but they tend to be superficial. They are on the surface. They don't dig down, which is something that journalists are trained to do and do well. And so, yes, I think it's a supplement. I don't think it can be a substitute.
You wonder, though, if people are satisfied with that or if they realize what's not there when you're not doing the real investigative reporting that requires more than passing on a quip from a councilman or woman.
That's right. I mean, I think that it may seem to fill the void, and it probably doesn't really fill the void. So there's a perception problem there, too.
What about the philanthropic model that you were describing earlier? How far can that go? Can that save these organizations, or have we reached a kind of a new status quo at a lesser level of inquiry?
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that yet, because this is all very new. I mean, one of the kind of cool things that's going on out there is a new effort called Report for America. And it's kind of like the Peace Corps or Teach for America, in which someone will do a year of service. Now, this isn't paid for by the government, but rather by foundations and in part by news organizations. But, you know, a young reporter will be assigned to a low coverage area, and you know, they hope, this program hopes to get 1,000 reporters out there within 5 years. So that actually could make an impact. And we're seeing lots of these new, you know, innovative and untested ideas start to come to fruition. And I think it's exciting and it has promise. Do I think it's going to completely, you know, fix the problem? No, I wish I could say that I see this as a fix, but I think there are steps in the right direction.
Are we going to see
people are understanding?
Are we going to see more papers collapsing further at the local level? Are we still on the way down in terms of financial strength that allows them to actually do the work?
We are still on the way down, without question. You know, in 1981, there were 1,700 daily newspapers in America. There are about 1,300 now. That will continue to fall, and there may be a tipping point at which a lot of local newspapers simply can't survive anymore. And that, you know, now, even though these newsrooms are smaller, they've shrunk, they still have the ability to cover a big event. They still have the ability to get the news out. And they actually do a tremendous job considering how stretched they are. But if the news organization goes away altogether, we're really going to see a very sad situation.
We're going to talk with Bob Schieffer in a moment about fake news and the facts. Do you worry about fake news taking the place of real understanding at the local level, or just plain unknowing, Margaret?
I do. And I think that, again, this issue of trust, you know, if you might run into your local reporter when you go grocery shopping, you have a pretty good idea that this is a real person. He or she is giving it to me straight. I think we're more exposed to the problems of fake news when we don't have the sort of the fabric of the local community news helping us.
Name a couple of papers where they're working the philanthropic front that people might look at.
Well, the Lexington Herald is doing it with Report for America. ProPublica has just started up an Illinois effort in Chicago, and that's an exciting idea, too. So those are two that come to mind.
We'll keep an eye on those. Margaret Sullivan is media columnist at The Washington Post. Margaret, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. It was good to talk with you.
In a moment, Bob Schieffer of CBS News looks at the deluge of news at other levels, both real and fake. We'll talk with Bob Schieffer. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. These days we have access to more information than ever before. How do we cut through all that and understand what is real and what is not? Bob Schieffer of CBS News has tried to answer that, and you can join us. How do you separate fact from fiction, especially when we have a president calling so much out there fake news? Joining me from New York is Bob Schieffer, longtime CBS News journalist, now political contributor for the network, former host of CBS's Face the Nation, member of the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, named a living legend by the Library of Congress in 2009, author of many books. His latest, co-written with Andrew Schwartz, is Overload: Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob Schieffer, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Proud to be here.
What's the problem you're attacking, sir?
Well, we are undergoing a technological revolution in communications that is having, I argue, as profound an effect on our culture as the invention of the printing press did on the people of that day. We talk about how the printing press improved literacy across Europe. We had the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation.
Yep.
But we also had 30 years of religious wars before we finally, in that day, reached equilibrium. We're right at the beginning of what we're involved in right now, and it's going to be a while before we work our way through it.
What's the face of the technology that's driving the revolution you're describing there?
Well, newspapers are in decline, and I was listening to Margaret Sullivan, and she's exactly right. We've lost 126 newspapers across the country in the last 12 years. One reporter in eight in the year 2004 lived in Washington, New York, or Los Angeles. That number is down to one in five now. So when you go out through the middle of this country, people are deluged, and most are getting their news from Facebook and other social media, but they're no longer getting any news from the places they used to depend on to form their opinions, and that is their local newspaper and even cable television, because now you're seeing cable cutting, so they're not even, they don't even have access to that. Many people, nearly everybody has a phone now, but they don't use it as a news gathering source. And if you're in a low economic group, you can't afford to pay for the news apps anyway. So in many places, you're simply getting no news.
And yet news, or the appearance of news, or fake news comes at people all the time. And at the same time, you've got a president who points to mainstream media and those cable channels, many of them, and says, in all caps, says, fake news, Bob. What about the impact of a president who labels so much of our news gathering realm fake newsmakers?
Well, I wish he wouldn't do it, because number one, it's wrong. But you're right. We are being overwhelmed with this stuff now. I mean, this awful shooting that happened in Las Vegas yesterday. Social media yesterday was filled with all kind of reports that the shooter was an anti-Trump liberal, that he loved my favorite
False.
Part, that he loved Rachel Maddow.
False, as far as we know.
That he had
we'll
converted
see.
To Islam.
Yeah.
And this was being spread all across Facebook and social media to the point that it kicked up on my phone, and I actually called CBS, and I said, did he convert to Islam? And they said, we have no information to that effect. And the FBI says no. But this is what's going on out there, and this is what's making it so difficult.
Do you have advice then for people, because you've got news organizations pulling back, or maybe people just aren't paying attention to them? They've got information or the form of news reporting flowing into their Facebook feed or past their eyes on Twitter. What's your guidance on how people can be well informed in the midst of all that?
Number one, buyer beware. Be aware that this stuff is out there. Depend on the sources that you have traditionally depended on for your news in the mainstream media. Because, you know, whatever else you want to say about us, we don't print something or broadcast something until we determine that it's true. And so you just have to be very discriminating in where you get your news. And the other part is never depend on simply one source on which to base your opinions, because you're going to get, and that's what's happened today. Now with the coming of these echo chamber channels and websites, you listen to one website or one channel and you get one set of facts. You listen to another and you get a different set of facts. And we're basing our opinions now on different data. It used to be based on common data. Now we're basing it differently. So it's no wonder that we're in the midst of this partisan divide. But, you know, the good news in this social revolution, media revolution, and what's happening here, I think the best story in journalism right now is Margaret Sullivan's newspaper, The Washington Post. They have totally reinvented themselves. NPR is doing much the same thing. The Washington Post is no longer a newspaper company. It's a media company, and it's putting its product out there on a variety of platforms, and they are doing it right. Now, the other part of it is Marty Baron, who's such a great newspaper editor, he also has an owner named Jeff Bezos. And Bezos has decided to let Baron run the newspaper. He wants to make it the best in the country, and they're doing a wonderful job there. The New York Times doing much the same thing. But the real problem is at that local level. And if we don't find some entity that does what we have come to expect from local newspapers, and that is keep an eye on the local government, we'll have corruption in this country at a level that we've never seen before.
Bob Schieffer's new book with Andrew Schwartz is Overload, Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News. He is with us from New York. Bob, we've got callers for you. Jim in Renfro Valley, Kentucky. Jim, you're on the air with Bob Schieffer.
Hi, Tom. As I'm listening to this, I've worked in I've done newspaper work before, and there's a phenomenon I'd like to discuss, which is what I call the rumor Doppler shift effect, which is where somebody will repeat a story to somebody else, and they repeat it to another person, and the content gets distorted, shifted. And finally, when it goes through enough people, the shift is about 180 degrees from what the original content was.
And online, that can go through a lot of people in a hurry, Jim.
I know, but I miss one of the disciplines I miss about working for a print newspaper is that at one time there was a firewall between the editorial, the op-ed section in the front page. Now I see news as it should have been, according to somebody's opinion. And that's what scares me. The objectivity seems to have gone by the wayside.
Bob Schieffer, who's winning this battle between just raw opinion, which may or may not be informed, rubbish or deliberately fake news, and we know this can come from all kinds of angles inside and outside the country at this point, and traditionally reported, responsibly reported news? What's winning, Bob?
Well, I think that at the reputable news agencies, there is a wall, and the most important thing at these reputable agencies is they don't publish something unless they've checked it out and think it's true. But I agree with your caller. I mean, we're seeing now the blending of opinion sometimes with objective news. And, you know, I did Face the Nation for many years, mm-hmm. and I did a commentary at the end of each broadcast, but it was also, there was a sign that ran across the bottom of the screen that said commentary, because I wanted to make people make sure they understood that this is what I thought about something. This was not necessarily just a who, what, when, where, and why part of the program. And I do think we need to do a better job of making sure people know when we're analyzing, that's what we're doing. We're not reporting just the straight facts.
But when you're talking about this technological revolution on a par with the days of the Gutenberg Bible and the first printing presses, every technology has its own impact. It creates a kind of reality around it, if we're not careful, or even if we are. I mean, where do you see the flood of information, right, wrong, good or bad, that inevitably comes with digital life. You know, can we have the old sense of dependable information, or do we just have to live in a new sort of free fire zone?
Well, this is the difference. It probably took in the days of the invention of the printing press, it took a week or so for news to get from one town to another. It took a long time to get it across the Atlantic Ocean and back again. Now, news goes around the world. I think it was Mark Twain who said, lies can go around the world and back while the truth is still putting its pants on. That is the difference now, is the lightning speed with which this stuff gets out there. And the trouble is, once it gets out there, it's hard to knock it down and remove it. I don't care how much fact-checking you do. You know, there still are a percentage of Americans who believe that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, that he's not really a U.S. citizen. Well, how much fact-checking do you have to do to knock that one down? And that's why Joe Nye up at Harvard at the Kennedy School says you can't just answer each lie when it's coming. This stuff is pouring out at fire hydrant-like force. You have to make sure people understand beforehand and inoculate them. Look, there's going to be stuff out there that is simply not true, that people are putting it out there for reasons, whatever they may be. But be aware of this and don't take everything at face value, especially when it pops up on the web.
Bob Schieffer's new book is Overload. Silas in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on with Bob. Thanks for calling, Silas.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm here. I
want to tell you,
woke up this morning, so that's a good start.
First of all, well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you're still doing the work you're doing. I'm 63 years old. I've been listening to you for a long time, and I appreciate all the efforts and good work you put into what you do.
Thank you, sir.
Let me first say, I agree with you on all your points about this garbage that's running around. And I believe that in this data-driven society, we have to expand our understanding of what the information is and give it a new title beyond simply using it, choosing the word fact. What we need to have out here is quantifiable data, data that we can trace back to a source that can be verified and establish that this is exactly what this is.
Silas, you're saying the word fact is no longer sufficient? I mean, why not? Can we not agree that there are things that are factual?
Well, there are things that are factual, but more importantly, what we need to have is quantifiable data that backs it up. Now, I say that because the word fact certainly does imply that it is true and whole, but depending on who spins the fact, it may not be truly quantifiable data that supports it. And you and I see that all too often.
I take your point. Now, I wonder if everything is quantifiable. But Bob, how about it? The sort of slipperiness of the idea of facts themselves when there's so much interpretation that goes on immediately.
Well, facts are facts. And we have to be prepared when we publish or broadcast something to explain how we got that information. I think one of the interesting things that's happening, and you're seeing this in the big newspapers now, they no longer just say a source said. It's almost hilarious wondering how many sources they're going to cite. Sometimes the Washington Post will say, according to 9 sources in the administration. And I think they're driving at just what our listener is talking about. And I think that's really helpful because, you know, especially in this White House, I used to tell people that the difference in covering the White House and covering Capitol Hill, which is still my favorite beat, Capitol Hill, I said, at the White House, they all work for the same person. But when you get up to Capitol Hill, they're all independent contractors. And that's how you get news. Well, that's no longer quite true because in the White House now, you have you have all these various factions. So when a reporter over there says, well, according to seven sources, he may have talked to 15 and three of them may have given him a different answer than what the other seven sources did. But I just think we have to do our best to, number one, be accurate and be prepared to back up whatever we say when we broadcast it or publish it.
What is the impact of having a president who repeatedly and with a heavy hand goes after news organizations as producing fake news?
Well, I don't think it's helpful. And, you know, whatever you think of this president or any other president, when the president speaks, that is going to have a certain impact. And I just don't think it helps at all.
Who wins in this? Do you see the kind of evolution going on in the news world that brings that out on top when you've got Russian trolls and everything else, you know, sort of going after the news flow, trying to massage it, change people's opinion?
There's no question that the Russians are heavily involved in this. And it's not just in this country. A woman named Heather Conley at the think tank CSIS wrote a fascinating study called The Russian Playbook, where she goes through and analyzes across Central Europe what the Russians have been doing there. The Russians don't drive their tanks across the borders anymore. They found a cheaper and better way to do it. They use cyber. They bribe the local politicians. They make sweetheart deals with the oligarchs in these various countries. They loan them money. And then they have an unrelenting attack on the news media and other institutions, mainly to just try to destroy their credibility. Joe Nye up at Harvard said that there's no question that the Russians were meddling in our elections because they were trying to, you know, just destroy credibility. And he said, and they got Trump as a bonus.
Bob Schieffer's new book is Overload, Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News. Bob Schieffer, terrific to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.